Hello, lovely podcast people. Welcome to another episode of Not Another Nutrition Podcast. The topic I'm going to talk about in this episode is something I literally just thought about in the gym last night. It's a bit of a random story why I started thinking about it, but I was just observing others and started thinking about the topic of spot reduction. That was how it began. Spot reduction being the ability to lose fat from a specific area of the body that you want to. That, you know, I really want to lose fat from my abs. I really want to lose fat from my legs. I really want to lose fat from the backs of my arms. These kind of things, some common areas. And there's long been this idea of, okay, we'll do exercise in those areas to tone that muscle. And, you know, even saying that out loud, I began to smile because it's just funny, this idea of toning and whatever. But what I then found myself thinking was, well, we now have, I believe, two studies that are very suggestive of the idea that maybe training a muscle group or a body part may well lead to slightly greater fat burning, fat oxidation, use of fat from that area. Now, these are what I would call, well, they're not mechanistic studies, but they are as close to us as possible. So we're not doing a study where we take two groups of people and we get them to do the same diet, the same macros, et cetera, the same training. But in one group, the same volume of training or the same kind of calories burn training, all of that kind of stuff, trying to keep stuff the same. But in one group, we get them to do sit-ups, for instance, or tricep kickbacks or whatever, and see, and then take body composition measurements, probably in this scenario, like a skin fold caliper done by someone trained well, and to see if we can get greater reductions in body fat in that area through doing that toning exercise of that muscle or body part. That hasn't happened, but we have these two studies that are suggestive of an increase utilization of adipose tissue. At least one study showed that. I can't remember what the other one showed. Something similar, though. It was a while back. Anyway, that's by the by. But for some of you, I imagine that will be new information. Two things I want to say on this, which I wasn't going to. But if someone wants smaller thighs, let's say, that's always a good one because people wear jeans and tightness of clothing. If someone wants smaller thighs, they don't necessarily want more defined thighs. So if it's abdominals, you're not going to make your abdominal region that much bigger doing sit-ups or whatever. But realistically, doing toning exercise on your quads, whatever that may be, squats and lunges, leg extensions, you could legitimately make your legs bigger. And I've spoken about this before. Personal trainers, strength and conditioning coaches, not listening to their clients, not really listening. They're hearing them, but they're not listening. And being, you know, slightly generic in their recommendations. So someone says, you know, I want to lose fat on my legs, and then I want my legs to be smaller, sorry. And then they give them lots of squats, etc. And because this person potentially has never been to the gym, they can gain a significant amount of muscle in a short space of time. And then they report back, you know, I think I'm getting fatter. I think I'm getting bigger. My jeans aren't fitting even worse, despite being in a calorie deficit, etc., etc. And then they get told that they're not adhering or whatever. But it's muscle gain. So that's a size issue. Then the definition issue. You know, can we see shape on the muscle and this kind of stuff is a different discussion. So do bear that in mind. But it does add to really what this podcast is about, which is bang for buck, utilization of time and effort and willpower and resources. So, you know, in this instance, what got me to thinking was, okay, we have this scenario of, you know, people still, evidence-based practitioners who aren't aware of this slightly new research going, you can't spot reduce, so, you know, what you need to do is X, Y, Z, which is technically incorrect. And it's good to be more informed than that. Of course, we should always all keep learning. But it's a little bit like when I talk about fat loss and meal timing and breakfast and meal frequency, these kind of things. And, you know, people who don't listen or only take snapshots of things I say might go, you know, Martin says that meal timing makes absolutely no difference to anything. I mean, that's a bold claim. But, you know, to fat loss, for instance. And, you know, meal frequency, realistically, almost makes zero, you know, absolute zero impact. But meal timing, we see differential effects of different types of timing of meals, whether that's a post-training timing or how calories are distributed throughout the day, and differences in, you know, even like blood glucose regulation, we can see differences. There's, you know, studies on skipping breakfast, and there's studies on eating more carbohydrate or more calories and carbohydrate protein at breakfast. Anyway, and the point of this is that in our recommendations, and I think this podcast, I probably should have said this at the beginning, is good for practitioners and for the layperson, because you will, it's really important to consider the magnitude of effect of, you know, whatever the recommendation, whatever the intervention is, and then to weigh that up against the effort and the strain on your resources. So, like, take fat burners, or take caffeine-based fat burners, you know, raising metabolism by a absolutely minimal effect. It is there, but it's minimal. And the cost of fat burners being astronomical. So, and also the fact that you can just get caffeine from other stuff, like Monster drinks. Mm. I've run out of white Monsters, so I had to go and buy these green ones. Not nearly as good. But for our Matt Nutrition Live event in November, we are... Oh, I don't know if I should tell you this. Oh, I've said it now. You know these new turquoise Monster Ultras? They're like Fiesta, mango Fiesta flavor, but they're like pretty much M&E turquoise. We think of like buying 400 of them and just giving every attendee that in their gift bag, their conference pack. That would just be quite cool. Anyway, make sure you save the date for that, by the way, 27th of November. It's going to be amazing. We already have something like 320 places allocated, tickets allocated to people from previous events through current MNU students who get a ticket automatically because of the payment plan they're on and all these different kind of things. Mentoring Lab, annual Mentoring Lab members who get a free ticket to live events. But 320 people already, tickets go on sale. In fact, soon, 27th of September, goodness me, depending on when we release this podcast, that's soon. So look out for that. Amazing topics line up. The best topic I think I've come up with, where intuitive eating meets intentional weight loss. What an epic topic. There's so much chat about intuitive eating at the minute versus intentional weight loss. You know, these two camps, you know, lots of the intuitive eating. Did I say intentional? No. Intuitive eating camp and non-diet camp, creating camps and using it purposefully to make money and sell books. And this, you know, they've lost really the client-centered approach. They're becoming very one-size-fits-all, which is not good, obviously. So yeah, the, you know, as is the MNUA, balanced, evidence-based, where those two, clients focused, client centered approaches. So that's going to be epic. We've got practical strategies on improving body image in yourself and clients. And then binge eating, practical strategies, and the theory, therapy and stuff around binge eating. It's going to be amazing. Such cool topics. 27th of November, East Midlands Conference Centre. So, and make sure you get the early, like super advanced or early bird. There's like super advanced tickets, which are half price for a week from like the 27th of, I think it's, are we in September now? Why don't I know the date? But yeah, like a few days time from this podcast. So have a look. Go on the Mac Nutrition Instagram and there'll be a link, but it's the MacNutritionMentoringLab.com website where we have the tickets for that, I believe. Anyway, I've gone off on one. How on earth? Oh yeah, Monster, caffeine. There we go, back on topic. But there's so many things like this, and it's just about the advice that we give people. It's super, super important for us to give the most time and effort and attention to the biggest bang for buck. So when we talk about, you know, calorie intake, it's the most important thing. Yes, other things will impact that. So people go, oh, how dare you talk about calorie intake without addressing sleep? Like, all right, mate, chill out. It's ridiculous. Like, yes, sleep might impact appetite, but that is then, so we, the first and foremost thing is for people to get on board with science, with the physics of the situation. And once they understand that, we can build on it. No one's only talking about calories and nothing else. I genuinely have never seen anyone just talk about calories and nothing else. And then looking at other stuff like protein that's going to help with appetite, like adequate sleep, which is going to help both with appetite, but also the ratio of fat to muscle loss in a deficit, for instance. And then we can talk about all the other factors that play into this. For example, maybe timing, but being like way, 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 way down the list of important factors. And then adherence to it being, you know, really the be all and end all. So anything that's impacting adherence, we can then talk about that. And that's, you know, other things that have popped into my head, like PCOS, which I'm talking about a lot at the minute with PCOS Awareness Month. You know, this, I have this bias towards lower carbohydrate intakes in so many different situations. You know, from the implementation aspect of it, it's so much easier to manipulate carbohydrate because they tend to be the largest part of people's diets. And they're not, lots of carbohydrates aren't super micronutrient dense in terms of, you know, if people are eating brown rice or oats, like these have some good things in them, but they're not giving us loads of important stuff, super important stuff that we can't get elsewhere. Sorry, I'm not long woken up. So I'm a bit croaky on this Saturday. So it's an easy thing to tackle. But in the PCOS realm, you look at the studies, and even when the study is talking about, you know, the low carbohydrate diet had, you know, significantly more favorable effects on metabolic markers. You know, that'll be the conclusion of these types of studies. But then you look at the study and they're literally comparing like a standard diet of say 55% carbohydrate with a 43% carbohydrate diet. And these individuals are eating 2000 calories a day. So, you know, if you do work the maths out here, we're talking 200 plus grams of carbs a day in women. I'm testing myself now. I reckon in that study, the average weight was around 80 kilograms. Like, it's a boatload of carbohydrate. We're not talking low 50 grams or less carbohydrate intake, or, you know, or anywhere near, you know, zero, keto, whatever, 20, 25 grams or less. Even the people talk about these like sweet spots, 100 grams of carbohydrate a day. Like, this is 200 grams of carbs a day. And they are getting this significantly better than the 55. So it is an interesting situation. But what it does also make room for is more polyunsaturated fats, which we know have benefit in PCOS. And the protein was consistent in the study that's actually springing to my mind. I'll post this study. I'll add it. Whoever's time pointing this podcast will add it for you. But you get this idea of, okay, we have this situation of what's going to help someone with PCOS. Oh, we need to focus on carbs loads. If that person then goes, look, I like to eat, you know, maybe if it went lower than 43%, we might get even more benefits to a point. For me, it's transient, it's short-lived. Once we've got on an even kilter, especially where weight loss is the goal, it doesn't matter so much. But, you know, it's also interesting that if someone has a very vegan or vegetarian-esque way of eating and a preference of eating, we've got all of these Kevin Hall studies which have used super, you know, like high carb, lower fat, low, you know, moderate low protein intakes, and had hugely satiating diets. People eating as much as they want, but they don't end up eating as many calories naturally, you know, subconsciously reducing their intake because they're so satiated by these super high fiber legume you know, higher fiber, higher protein, plant-based sources of carbohydrate. And so, you know, it's what is going to have the biggest impact on the person. And, you know, in a woman with PCOS who wants to lose weight and has a good amount of weight to lose, and we think, yeah, this is a positive step, getting her in a calorie deficit is the most important thing. And we then look at the, you know, the other surrounding studies around this, and it's a case of, yeah, it doesn't matter what approach you take as long as someone's adhering to that. So again, when we talk about meal timing, what's going to help someone adhere best to what they're doing? Now, they have to adhere to a principle. That's the important thing. What are they adhering to? They need to adhere to the principle of the thing they're trying to bring about. So if they need, you know, if they're celiac and they need to go gluten-free, they're not adhering to a calorie deficit. It's the best way for them to adhere to a gluten-free way of eating, which, you know, I've opened a can of worms. I can't even possibly think what that would be. Probably lots of stuff around education, actually. But anyway, and there's all sorts of things. So again, it's understanding the magnitude of effect. I think maybe that's what I'm going to call this podcast, like understanding the magnitude of effect of dietary interventions for fat loss. I'll chuck in fat loss in there because people tend to listen when I put that in the title, you little jokers. So, you know, there's this paper when I debated Tim Noakes, the keto zealot, on a Sigma Nutrition podcast. He brought up this paper by Bueno, or I think I brought it up. I don't think he actually cited a single piece of research. I cited the Bueno paper. And but you look at that paper and it's like, oh, low carbohydrate diets had a significantly greater weight loss over 12 months. And then you look at the study and I'm pretty sure it's like 0.9 kilograms or maybe 1.2, I forget, kilograms over 12 months. That was the difference, but it met statistical significance. And then it's like, oh, cool. Like, I'd much rather not have that, but have loads more dietary flexibility, loads more ability to eat different foods that I like. Like, they've only measured one marker there. What's, you know, what's the gut profile? What's the gut health of the individuals in that group versus that group? You know, long term. You know, what's the happiness? What's the profile of mood state scores for these people who have gone super low carb versus whatever? So, these things are just worth bearing in mind. What's the magnitude of the effect of these different things? You know, what's the most important thing for us to pay attention to? So, you know, going back to the spot reduction thing, yes, it's great. People should be considering if they want a body part to be more defined or even smaller, a calorie deficit is going to be the most important thing. But we can also tell them, yes, some training in that area. And it's like, okay, I don't want any more muscle in that area. Okay, well, if you do train that area, you need to train nowhere near failure, because we don't want to be, we want to be as minimally as possible eliciting, you know, a hypertrophy response in that area. You know, not using high loads. I'm not a training expert, but imagine if you use high loads, even if you don't, you know, and you get enough volume and you don't go to failure, you're still gonna stimulate some hypertrophy. So that's really what I wanted to discuss. It's just something for us to bear in mind. What's the magnitude of that? Like, you know, research on like the FTO gene, which is the I guess what people are calling like the fat gene. It's not slowing people's metabolism. The research shows that people with, you know, the double allele FTO gene, they have higher appetites and they tend to eat more over time, and therefore that's why we've got this correlation with BMI or higher body weights or body fat. But with a weight loss intervention, at least in the short term, the FTO gene is not a mediator in the success of a weight loss program. So with good behavior change and nutrition interventions, even people with, you know, this FTO gene can make the same progress. It's not stopping them losing weight. So it's just important for us to understand, like, and the reason I said that, sorry, is like sleep. It's like, okay, well, this, what's the most important thing for me to talk to this person? If they genuinely are just struggling with appetite and they just are always starving and they don't stick to anything, then we go, appetite's the most important thing for us to tackle. And we look at all the strategies with regards to protein and types of food and sleep and stress that we can maybe help, you know, and the palatability of their overall diet, that we can hopefully change appetite. But it's understanding what you're trying to achieve that's important. Something popped into my head there about appetite. Oh yeah, it was just an off the cuff. This is why these weight loss injections, which get lots of bad press and lots of sort of dumb personal trainers hating on them, when they are a legitimate medical intervention. Now, if the personal trainer or whoever is hating on them, the skinny jab, I guess, GLP-1 antagonists, I believe. I can't say the name of them because it's not common vernacular. Is that? Oh, Alexa, define vernacular.
As an adjective, vernacular is usually defined as of language, native or indigenous, opposed to literary or learned.
That'll do.
Noun, Alexa, is usually defined.
Stop now. Come on, stop showing off. So, liguanrinutide. Anyway, you know the ones I mean. That would be cool if I learned to say them. I remember this talk at Body Power where there's this gimp speaking before me, and he had learnt loads of, like, yeah, green tea, man, green tea will get you shredded. You know, the EGCG, man, epigallocatechin-gallate. Look at that. For all the geeks out there, it'll get you shredded, man. I literally got on stage and absolutely rinsed him. Told everyone I was a joker. Where was I? So, these things are essentially pharmaceutical appetite suppressants. So the problem is people go, I'm adhering to my diet. And then, you know, you'll hear people like Spencer Nadolsky talk about this in a very compassionate way, but also an interesting way, that he'll work with these clients and they're like, I'm only eating 1,000 calories a day and I'm doing this exercise and I can't lose weight. And then he'll work with them on their dietary you know, quality and you know, get some good resistance training maybe in their diet and this, that, and the other. They might lose some weight, they might plateau. And they're essentially, they're either lying to themselves or they're lying to him. And people don't like to be told that. I've had some stuff on the, my PCOS stuff this month. Oh, all of these, you're just supporting all these people who say that women with PCOS are liars. Like, you're human, you're a liar. Like, that's it. That's where it ends. And the research shows that women lie more than men. Yeah. I'm joking. Well, I'm not joking. They underreport more than men. And in my tour, I go into that in a very compassion-focused way and why I believe that would be the case. But it's not nice to be told it. I get that. But I'm not... Like, science doesn't care about your feelings. And realistically, when I'm talking about facts, I don't care about your feelings when I'm just stating facts. I want you to hear and listen, but I'm not saying you're a liar knowingly, but as a human, we underreport when we diet. It's just one of those things, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of calories that you don't realize you're not eating. Like, trained dietitians, put in a lab, please record your food intake. Even they're getting it wrong, even when they're told that they're being watched and recorded. So it happens. Deal with it. As soon as you stop fighting back and just accept it, you actually get somewhere. So you then give these individuals who, you know, swear blind that they're adhering, you then give them this appetite suppression injection, and they suddenly start losing weight. And they think, oh, that the injection really worked. It's boosted my metabolism. It's making me burn more fat, blah, blah, blah. That's not how it works. All it does is it makes you adhere. Like, what are you eating? I'm eating exactly the same, but I'm now losing weight. Well, we know the mechanism by which this injection works, and it's by making you eat less. So, you know, what's happening? And it's so obvious that simply we know what's happening is they may be snacking less, or they may be adhering more, and they may be binging less, or whatever is happening, but realistically they're just adhering to a calorie deficit now. I tell you what, this podcast has had some good stuff, I think. The main crux of it, though, was just focusing. I mean, even that one, it's like, okay, when someone can't adhere, how can we make them adhere? Not just by going shaming them, or you're rubbish, or you're not adhering. It's like, what can we do? Let's find out where this is coming in. What's going wrong? I'm getting a phone call. And then let's look at ways to manage that and change that. Cool. I think that's everything I wanted to say. So, just a reminder, MNU Live. Mac Nutrition Live. It's not an MNU event. It's open to everyone, the lay public. 27th of November, East Midlands Conference Centre, after party. We're hopefully getting a massive area for the after party in Nottingham, and bigger than we've ever had before. We've already got 90 people booked on for the evening dinner. For the after party. It's going to be great. Tickets on sale 27th of September if you want to attend. Drop me a message or DM on Instagram if you want more info. Until next time, much love.